her read from the Analects or the Conversations of Confucius with his disciples and certain other people. In one of the translations by the author Arthur Wheely, in the introduction he says that one can construct at least half a dozen Confucius's out of the legend concerning his life and work. Because he was described by some as a moral teacher, a wise man, a prophet, and a magician. If you turn to theosophical literature, you find that in the ocean of theosophy we are told that Confucius was an adept, that he formed the ethical triad along with Buddha and Jesus. That is to say that Buddha, Jesus, and Confucius are the three teachers, masters, adepts, who laid emphasis on morals and ethics. H.P. Blavatsky tells us in The Secret Doctrine that Confucius, along with Plato, was a fifth rounder. That is to say that what average, ordinary humanity, the knowledge which it will be able to have, the progress that it will reach in the fifth round, that is in a far distant future, Confucius achieved it in the fourth round itself. Thus, we must agree with the authors who say that it is better to deal with one Confucius at a time. Now, if we turn to the Confucius of the history, we find that he was born in about 551 BC in the state of Lu in China, and Confucius is the Latinized version of Kung Fu Tzu, meaning Kung the philosopher. We are told that his father was known for his great strength, valor, courage. He was a knight and he was an official of a certain territory. That Confucius was his son only from his second wife, from his second marriage. And again, there are many legends regarding his birth, and one of them says that when his mother once was sitting, a spirit appeared before her and said, "You will bear a son, a sage, and you must bring him forth in the hollow mulberry tree." Now, the mother was puzzled and she asked her husband, and she was told that there is a cave by that name, and it is said that then she gave birth to Confucius in that cave. Now, when Confucius was born, he was named Qiu or Qiu because of his prominent and large forehead. It is also said, according to certain biographical accounts, that he was unusually tall, 9 feet 6 inches, whereas the average height in his time was only 7 feet. Now, we are told that the first biographical account on Confucius was written in a work called Historical Records by a person called Suma Qian in the 1st century BC. Whereas we see that he was born in between 5th and 6th century BC. So mostly the scholars say that you should not really lend credence to all which is being said in the biographical account, even there, because there is a lag of some 400 years. Now, if we turn to another Confucius, as it were, the Confucius of the Analects, there we find he is described as the person who was engaged with training the sons of the aristocrats. He was inculcating in them morality, virtue, which were required so that they can become fit to rule the state, to govern the state. And we are told that he was not very happy with this position, that he always longed to have a hand in the affairs of the state, because he was in lookout for a ruler who will understand and accept his way. We shall see more about his way, the way of goodness, or the way of the former kings, as he called it. He was in lookout for a certain ruler, but it seems that he had to remain till the end satisfied being a knight himself, or rather the leader of the knights. And we are told that in search of such a ruler, he used to travel a lot, far and wide, to all the eastern provinces from the state of Lu. And he never used to care in these travels about his food, about the fatigue, and he was of great strength and courage, physical strength at least. And we are told that on one such journey, when one of his disciples complained because there was not enough food and they were all tired. And he said, Master, even a man of high order have to suffer want? And it is said that Confucius replied that yes. But the difference is that whereas a superior man bears want unshaken, the inferior man in want, he gets demoralized. Now, this is a very important concept. We shall turn to it later about the concept of superior man or gentleman in the ancient Chinese tradition. Now, we find that we'll have to turn then to the conversations that he had with his disciples for understanding his counsel, his teachings. Because as the reason is given by one of the authors called Raymond Dawson in his book on Confucius, that in his time in the ancient China, there was the literature consisting of what is called 13 classics, which included history, philosophy, and various other arts. And out of this, only some 5 books, like the Book of History, the Book of Changes, Book of Rites, are attributed to have been either compiled or commented upon or edited by Confucius himself. So he says that we see the difficulty that out of these great work, which was considered as the repository of truth, which shall we call was the teachings of Confucius and which shall we attribute to other philosophers? Because we are reminded that Confucianism was only one of the 3 religions in China. The other 2 is Buddhism and Taoism. Now, this being the difficulty, generally analects are the teachings upon which people depend upon to understand his teachings. Now, even the analects, the conversations he had with his disciples, we are told, these were compiled by 2 of his disciples much later after his death. Here again, you find that there were certain interpolations later on. There is a difficulty because they are aphorisms. These are very terse sayings. No context has been provided, the context in which he would have said a certain thing. Now, because of this, there is a difficulty of understanding the meaning. There is also, therefore, the impression, when it is just read by a person, that these are very commonplace. They are just passed off as being banal. In the Secret Doctrine at one place, H.P. Blavatsky tells us that even today there are certain works available. And the nature of these works is such that unless and until you have volumes of commentaries and explanations on them, you will not be able to understand. And she classes the works by Lao Tzu and Confucius in this category, that you need to have the proper explanation. Now, if we turn to the analects then, first let us see what is being said by the master himself, on master himself. What we find over there emerging out is his love of learning. He says, at the age of 15, I set my heart on learning. In one place he says that I do not claim to have any unusual stock of knowledge. What I regard exceptional about myself is my love of learning. So he is found saying that even in a hamlet, in a village of 10 houses, you may find men who are sincere and as conscientious as I am, but you will not find a man who has that same intense love of learning which I have. That's the only place in which, that's the only respect in which he feels he is different or he is exceptional. Now, his love of learning again, what was it directed towards? It is so that you learn, you practice the teachings and set finally an example of being a good moral person. As we shall have the occasion to see, he puts a great emphasis on setting an example by the people who are in the position higher and then imitating this example by the people who are in the inferior or subordinate position. Now, as for the following of the example, he has some definite things in mind. For example, in places, we understand his love of antiquity. As for example, when he says, as a transmitter, not as an originator, a believer in and lover of antiquity, I venture to compare myself with our ancient worthy Peng. Now, first of all, we see here, he doesn't claim originality like all the great teachers. H.P. Blavatsky herself, when she writes Secret Doctrine, in the introduction she says, What I'm about to give here is to be found scattered in thousands of volumes of European and Asiatic literature. She doesn't say it. She's revealing anything. So even Confucius says he's only a transmitter. And then he speaks about his love of antiquity. There is this whole concept of ancients. Now, who were the ancients which he felt that the people of his time must follow? This, it is said, were the rulers of the early Chao dynasty. And this Chao dynasty was the period he considered as the golden age, because these were the ideal rulers, which he called as the true kings. Then again, we are told that these ancients were the divine sages. The mythological figures which I have talked of, who were supposed to have ruled or guided the human dynasties at some time or the other. Now, even about these divine sages, he says that these were, we are reminded of the adept kings, which are spoken of in the Hindu tradition, that they govern without governing, that they did not have to really do anything, but just people followed their moral example, their divine presence was enough. So regarding one sage, he says that he just sat with his face turned in the southern direction. We are told he didn't really have to govern the people in any sense. Now, on the other hand, he also says you don't have to go very far searching for an example. If you are eager to learn, you can learn even from the people around you. So in these two sayings we find, he says, when walking in a party of three or with two others, my teachers are always present. I can select the good qualities of one and copy them, and the unsatisfactory qualities of the other and correct them in myself. Not criticize them, see that and correct them in myself. When you see a man of worth, think how to rise to his level. When you see an unworthy man, then look within and examine yourself. So here again, in following anything, any example, he talks of what they call as su, that is to think, observe, analyze, pay attention to. That when you see something good, don't blindly follow it. He says, when you want to act, look into their matter at least twice before you actually put things into action. Again, he speaks about observing by saying and thinking that the knowledge which is not thought over is useless, as he says in one place. And so it is not surprising that he paid a lot of attention even to education. And contrary to what was prevalent at his time, where education was imparted to or thought fit to be given, was to the people who held proper social position. And here we find Confucius saying that education, while you impart it, it's not important to see what is the social status of the person. What is important is the eagerness, the willingness of the pupil to learn. So in one place he says that from the bringer of a bundle of dried meat onwards, I have never refused to instruct anyone. Now, the bundle of dried meat, we are told, it's the symbol of the humblest form of offering. So from the humblest pupil, he would accept anyone who was eager to learn. Now, the other reason for this is because he regarded that all men have the innate capacity in them or potentiality to grow. All men have, in fact, the potentiality to become a sage in turn. And that is why he was willing to educate even the humblest person. Now, we said that this was all about him and his love for learning and his attitude towards learning. Now, when we come to morals, we are told about the great concept of Jen, J-E-N, Jen, that is spoken of. Now, Jen, in the earlier China, it was just translated to mean the true member of a tribe, just like you would say a true Indian or a true Englishman. But later it was translated as being good, and still later some translated it to mean goodness and humaneness. Now this he considered as the sublimest virtue, because finally it meant manifesting one's true human nature. And we find that at 60 places in the Analects he talks of Jen, he talks of this humaneness in different ways. And so sometimes this Jen is translated to mean something like compassion, kindness, altruism, love, and so on. And this is to be practiced by the most humble as well as the person at the highest level. Now, to understand this, therefore, let us see what he has to say about humaneness. He says, when he is asked about humaneness, it is to love others. Elsewhere he says, it is the denial of self and response to what is right and proper. Deny yourself for one day and respond to the right and proper, and everybody will accord you virtuous. When wrong and improper, do not look. When wrong and improper, do not listen. When wrong and improper, do not speak. Elsewhere he says, he who could practice 5 things everywhere would be humane. Courtesy, generosity, good faith, diligence and kindness. If you behave with courtesy, then you will not be insulted. If you behave with generosity, you will win multitude. If you are of good faith, then other men will put their trust in you. If you are diligent, you will have success. If you are kind, you will be able to command others. Then again, he speaks of, do not do to others what you would not like yourself. That is a very, very famous saying by Confucius. Now, another important thing that we find in the Analects being told is about filial piety. The reverence for the parents, filial piety, the reverence for the parents when they are alive and also when they are dead. He speaks of taking care of the parents, especially in their old age, feeding them, looking after them, and then providing them with a worthy funeral when they are dead. But also, he laid, attached great importance to the paternal influence on the action and mind of the son. So it is said that once when he had the opportunity, for some time he was acting as a chief justice, he was reviewing a case where a son, where the father brings the son for justice and for punishment. He says that, look, it is not right when people in the superior position, when they don't really do their duty, and then they propose to inflict punishment on the people who are in the inferior position. And in this case, he says, I find that the father has failed to teach the son his filial duty. So on the one hand, it was the father's duty to inculcate in the son this sort of filial piety or the filial emotion. It is his duty, which he has not done. So both of them, we are told, were sent to jail, both the father and the son. Now, we are also told, there is a whole book called the Book of Filial Piety. And in the first chapter, it is said that the beginning of the filial piety is with one trying to pay reverence to the physical body. That the physical body you have obtained from your parents, through your parents. So you must not misuse your physical body. And the end of filial piety consists in living the virtuous life, molding your character. Finally, you leave behind a name for the posterity to remember, and thus you will glorify your parents. In one place regarding this filial piety, he says, when the father is alive, you only see the son's intentions. It is when he is dead that you see the son's actions. If for 3 years he makes no change from the ways of his father, he may be called filial. Now, even before we go any further, it is important to see why did he emphasize whatever he did. First of all, we find that when he speaks of virtue, he is not concerned with a virtuous man in isolation. All the virtues that he talks about are the ones which have a direct bearing in relationship with human beings, in dealing with other human beings. How is it going to bear upon that? Secondly, we find that the way in which he puts is again appropriate to the climate of his time, the psychology of the people of his time, in the sense that we see he doesn't talk about democracy, he doesn't talk about justice or liberty or some such thing. He is appealing to the basic human instinct, or rather some authors say to the basic animal instinct, because the animal instinct is where the young one always looks up to for help and guidance to the one that is elder. So this is what he also encourages, that those who are inferior has to look for the example to those who are superior. Again, he talking about humaneness and goodness. He doesn't say that you have to be good and leave it at that. The way in which he puts is, do not do unto others as you would not like yourself, as Buddha says in one place, in the Rod of Punishment, that placing oneself in the, I mean, putting oneself in the place of another, one should neither slay nor cause to slay. So that is, use your own feelings as a guide when you do something. The positive rendering of this is, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, as it is said in Bible. Now this again is an important doctrine called the doctrine of reciprocity. And this reciprocity is at all levels, not only in the relationship of the human beings in a family or society, but even in a government, as we shall see later. He speaks of the reciprocity, that if the ruler is kind and good, he will get the response, the loyalty from his subjects. Now, even again, before we see other things that he has taught, let us see the political and the historical background in which he was working. We are told that it was the period, 5th and 6th century BC, the period when the Chao dynasty rulers, which he praised so much as being the ideal rulers, their authority had already disintegrated. China was divided now into 12 different kingdoms, which were warring with each other for a kind of supremacy. It was a time when we are told that the ministers of the states were just killing the royal princes for usurping power. It was a time when the sons were rebelling against their fathers and killing them. It was a period of complete lawlessness and anarchy. If you come back nearer to the state of Lu in which he was born, it was at that time having the government which could be called as aristocratic oligarchy, wherein there was the rule by aristocratic families. It was a time when the autocratic government was set up by them, so much so that all the higher positions were filled up by them, like the premier or the general of the army, who would always come from an aristocratic family. The military force of the state had been turned into the private army of the aristocratic family. Now, in this situation, therefore, he has to talk about turning within and examining your own self. And that is why it is relevant that he has to also speak of what is it that constitutes a gentleman? What is it that constitutes a knight? Again, as we had alluded to earlier, there is this concept of gentleman or a superior man, which is in Chinese called as Chunzu. Now, this concept of the gentleman, it was important for him to once again make clear, because in his time, people felt that those who were born in aristocratic families, those who were descendants of rulers, were the gentlemen or the superior people. But he had to show that it is not the birth which makes you really superior. It is the inner character. It is the following of virtue, the man who practices virtue, he is the gentleman or a superior man. So he says that a gentleman or a man of honor is one who practices morality. He tries to cultivate himself in such a way that he can bring about tranquility in the people around him. He distinguishes between the superior man and the inferior man by saying that the superior man is more concerned with what is right and just, whereas the inferior man is concerned with what will profit him. That the inferior man, not having the moral training, is still bothered about profit and loss, about his material welfare, but not so the gentleman. So also, in the reading we had today, that the gentleman, if he forsakes the practice of the virtue, how is he going to fulfill his name? Which means that the practice of virtue was considered as implicit in the meaning of gentleman. That when you say a particular person is a gentleman, it goes without saying that he's the one who practices morality. He's the one who is virtuous. Now, this fulfilling of the name is another important Chinese doctrine, which they call as rectification of name. It was felt, rectification of name, it was felt at that time that people should live in accordance with the title they bear. That the titles which are given, and by which it is not meant the title of a prince or the title of a ruler, it even includes things like son, father, mother. If you call yourself a son or a father or a ruler, you have to live your life in such a way as to fulfill that title. Because after all, they felt that there is a definite meaning behind every title. And therefore, you must try and fulfill that. So when he was asked, what are the principles of government? And he said, let the prince be prince, minister be minister, father, father, and son, son. That just let everyone do their duty according to their labels, and that will have a proper government. Now, on the one hand, there is the common people on the highest level, the gentlemen, but in between there was a class which we are told was called as the knights, in the Chinese called as Shi, S-H-I-H. And these knights, this is the class of people who were the sons either of the aristocratic family, they were either the descendants of rulers who never got a chance, because in the ancient China at that time, hereditarily they were put in the position, official position in the government. Now these are the people who did not hereditarily get the chance of doing anything in the affairs of the state. And these were the people who were being trained. And Confucius, as we saw, was training such people in fitting them to rule later on. We are told that these knights, they had to learn 6 different kinds of arts. They had to have knowledge and at the same time also have military skills. They were being looked upon as a kind of reserve. They were kept in reserve so that slowly there was a shift from hereditary occupation of the position to occupying the position by merit. So someday these people would get a chance in the affairs of the state. Now, knight is not just used in the sense of the soldier knight. Again, Arthur Wayley in the introduction tells us that when he speaks about knight, he also means those people who were the defenders of his way. Because after all, the same qualities, stout-heartedness, courage, resolution and determination are going to be required by people who are going to defend his way, his teachings, as they are required by the soldier knight. So the knights in that sense are also the, we can call them the spiritual warriors of the Confucian army. Now later on, by knights only scholar or the literary person were meant. Now regarding them, he says, what must a man be like to be called knight? The master said, one who in conducting himself maintains a sense of honor, and who when sent to the four quarters of the world does not disgrace his prince's commission, may be called a knight. The determined knight, it is also translated as the resolute scholar and a virtuous man, will not seek life at the expense of virtue. They will even sacrifice their lives in order to achieve humaneness. So the one who is defending the virtue should be such that he should be able to even give up his life if the occasion arose. Now he had definite views, as we are more familiar with his views regarding government. And he said that a good government rather would be the one where the government provides enough food, enough weapons, and the government which would have the confidence of the people. Now when he was asked that suppose it was not possible to have at least 2 of these things, then what are these 2 things for which you would make allowance? And he said, well, you can do without weapons. Even if the government is not able to provide enough food, that is fine, because after all, man has to die one day. But when the government does not have confidence of the people, that government can never stand. Now, we find that for him, government was there for rectification of people. Government was there for setting again the moral example. As we saw earlier, the ruler must be such that he is concerned with the welfare of his subject. He should behave like a true father, and then his subject will also respond, will be loyal and faithful to the ruler. Now, therefore, he laid emphasis on the government for the people. But he also laid emphasis on the consultation of the people in running the government. So at one occasion, when someone came a little late to his assembly, he asked, why were you late? And the person said that, well, I was busy with the affairs of the state. And Confucius said that you couldn't have been busy with the affairs of the state. There must be some family matters. Because had they been affairs of the state, even though I'm not engaged in office, I should have been consulted. So he feels that in everything that happens in the government, consultation of the people is very important. Then also, he had this idea about those who are not directly participating in the government can indirectly participate in the government. And how was it? According to him, the way you live your life, and he attached a great importance to family units. We know that he considered the families as microscopic units which go to form the macrocosm of the state. So he says that if the families would follow the moral code, if they maintain order within the families, then it is going to facilitate the rule of the government. They will have to do very little in order to bring about the civil order in the entire state. Not only that, he goes a little more further and says that what is really constituted by a family? I mean, what constitutes a family? It is an individual. So if the individual himself follows virtues, then there will be a good family, and then there will be a good state, and so on. So he felt that there would be peace and prosperity throughout the world based on the virtuous individual. Now, as to these two things, let's have his own words. What does the book of history say about filial piety? And he said, only be dutiful towards your parents and friendly towards your brothers, and you will be contributing to government. By being doing your duty as father, as son, you will be contributing to government. These virtues also constitute taking part in government. You need not be really any official in the government, but even by living a proper good life as a son or a daughter, you can participate in the affairs of the state. And then there is this very famous saying by him where he says, the ancients who wished to perpetrate great virtue throughout the empire first learned to govern their own states well. Wishing to govern their states well, they first put their family relationships in order. Wishing to have their families in order, they first cultivated their own lives. And wishing to cultivate their own lives, they first regulated their mind. So everything it boils down to regulating the mind, acquiring the virtue, living a pure and moral life. And this being his view, he therefore was against imposing of the laws. He never was for imposing the laws and then controlling people through fear of punishment. And here we are told he was at loggerheads with the legalists of his time. The legalists always felt that you can control people only by instilling in them the fear of punishment. And Aristotle had two arguments against this. First, he said, what laws you make, first of all, will not be able to take into account all the possible human circumstances. It will not take into account all possible human circumstances. Secondly, he said that if you make laws, they'll be of a nature where you will want to again instill fear in people. So you are not molding the character of the people. These laws will not educate them, rectify them, or even kind of bring transformation in the people. And he was worried about bringing the transformation in the people from within. And we here find the echo of what H.P. Blee says in the Key to Theosophy, that when you make laws, when you take measures, they should be corrective measures and not punitive. That's what even Confucius had to say, that it should be such as to educate and not just automatically and mechanically make people follow the good or the true out of fear of punishment. And so in his time, there were what are called as pa or paramount princes who ruled by force. And there were, on the other hand, wang or the ideal kings, the true kings, who ruled by moral power. Because they set an example, they could actually awaken morality into their subjects. They could awaken their conscience. They could awaken morality in them because they were themselves moral. Now, therefore, when he was asked by a person about his opinion on capital punishment, he says, what need, sir, is there of capital punishment in your administration? If your aspirations are for good, sir, the people will be good. The moral character of those in high position is the breeze. The character of those below is the grass. When the grass has the breeze upon it, it assuredly bends. It's a very beautiful simile, that the moral character of the people in high position is like a breeze, and it can never remain without affecting, like the breeze affects the grass, and the grass bends under that breeze. So also, the example of that person in the high position, a ruler or the head of a family, will affect those who are in the inferior position. Now, he also spoke about, as he said, way, the way of goodness. And he said, you must live your life in accordance with the way was the way different from the way spoken of as Tao by Lao Tzu, which is more metaphysical. Here, the student can only go by what the other authors have said. It looks more like it was the way of goodness, or it is the way of how to run the state or government, such that finally there will be order and harmony in the state. That's the way that he spoke about. And here he says that people should live in accordance with the way. Not only that, he says that if you happen to be occupying a certain position in the government, and if you find at a certain point in time that now you have come to a state where your commitment to the way is coming in conflict with your position in the government, then you should be willing to resign that position. And as some authors point out, this was a very, very radical advice, because in those days, and of course even in these days, we find people have great ambition to be engaged or involved in the affairs of the state. And especially in his time, people were going through a lot of difficulty. We shall see later what all they had to do just in order to be in some official position to be in government. And here he was advising that if your virtue, if you find that if that is coming in conflict with your adherence to the virtue, to the way, you should be willing to resign that position. And of course, he himself, as we saw, wanted to have a hand in the affairs of the state, but he did not get this opportunity. And as to that, at times he has said in frustration, "Am I a bitter god only to be hanged but not to be eaten?" He was a little frustrated and disappointed. And yet he continued his teaching and cultivation of the other people who he found maybe one day find place in the government. Now, therefore, as to the way, he says, "What I call a great minister serves his ruler in accordance with the way. And when it is impossible to do so, he resigns." Now, it is not as though he taught, obviously not. He taught what is given in the NLX or the conversations. Again, out of that, we have chosen only very few popular things or doctrines which are prevalent, especially in his days in China. It is not only that he taught the disciples, as it were, sitting under a banyan tree in public, but we are told that he also gave out esoteric preachings. As always, every religion has the esoteric and the exoteric side. Even he gave out the esoteric teachings. And as to that, we are told that his grandson, called Zezu, is supposed to have recorded these esoteric teachings in the book called The Doctrine of the Mean. The Doctrine of the Mean is the book which contains his esoteric teachings. And in the introduction, it is said that he has written that, "I was afraid that in the course of time, some of these teachings may get lost, some of these teachings may get deteriorated. Because it was only an oral tradition, he thought it fit to actually put it into writing." H.P. Blavatsky has got a few references about certain of his teachings which are of a little abstruse nature, which the student doesn't feel competent enough to discuss, but they are there in the secret doctrine. Here and there, she makes mention of Confucius. But as we said, we don't feel competent to discuss them. But we can just keep in mind that it is not as though this is the only thing which Confucius had to teach. Now, naturally, we may wonder that for how long was his influence? As it were, for how long people remembered his teachings? As to that, again, as we saw earlier, to occupy any position in the government at that time, there was this procedure of passing the civil service examination. Now, here we are told that in 1583, certain Roman Catholic missionaries, they reached China. And in trying to come closer to the emperor, they found that in order to come closer to emperor, first they had to be friends with the scholars with which the emperor was surrounded. For that, they found they have to themselves be scholars in their turn. Now, to be scholars, they found they had to pass the civil service examination. And that consisted of learning at least 4 books which contained Confucius' teachings. Things like Book of History, the Book of Change, the Doctrine of Mean that was mentioned, then the Great Learning. Some of these authors have mentioned these. The student is not very sure. But some of these books they had to study. And it was only in 1905, with the Imperial China slowly being replaced with the Republic of China, finally this system was abolished. But it is not as though his teachings were lost. Such a great person, his teachings still remain. And here and there, people must be studying, and we hope remembering and trying to follow his teachings. The greatest thing which has been said, I mean, the tribute that we can pay, or what we can say about him, is in terms of what that great historian, the historian Suma Xian, wrote about him in his book, is to say, "The world has seen many men, from kings down to ordinary men of talent and virtue, who have found glory during their lives, which has come to an end with their deaths. But Confucius, although he wore the cotton gown of a commoner, has maintained his reputation for more than 10 generations, and men of learning exalt him. From the Son of Heaven and the princes and nobles downwards, all those in the middle of kingdom, who speak of the six arts are guided and corrected by the master, and this may be regarded as perfect sagehood." The question asked is some idea about his metaphysical teaching. As the student confessed, she has not really come across in the Analects anything really which can be called as metaphysical, because these conversations with her disciples, if you go through all the conversations, all the Analects which are there, they look more like trying to instruct into as to how to live your life, just in the day-to-day dealing with the people, as we said. But there are other books, and the student has not had time really to consult other books in order to say, find out what were the metaphysical teachings. That way the question also arises as to what he had to say about God and things like that. In the introduction, of course, the mention has been made by Arthur Wheely about the term Tien, T-I-E-N, which meant heaven, but he says that it can also be translated to mean nature, providence, and so on. And there he seems to suggest the presence of God, the protection from God, the providence, the law. And in those terms, that's the only thing which is little beyond the virtues and that which has been mentioned. But as we said, in the Secret Doctrine, here and there, around three places, HPB has made a mention in connection with what the student doesn't remember and has not really taken the trouble to go into metaphysics. So, must confess ignorance. The question is, can we call him a religious teacher? Now, according to what we understand in theosophy, I mean, this is how student has been hearing all throughout, is that no teacher really comes to establish a religion in that sense. Religion with a label, that they always come and give some teachings, which are then put in proper order by the disciples, and then a label is given also by the disciples, as say Buddhism, Hinduism. But a teacher never comes with these certain teachings, saying that call this as this religion or that. And yet, in the sense of religion in which we understand in theosophy, that religion is that which binds men and women throughout the world, religare, as it is said, from which it comes, to bind together once again. Well, in that sense, he was a religious teacher. In another sense, we can call him as religious in the sense that there is a lot of mention being made about rituals, ceremonies of his time, and he is supposed to have written a book on rituals. And there he guides people as to even the ordinary religious ceremonies, starting from the very way in which they should really conduct towards each other, the way you should sit, the way you should welcome your guests, the manners which we call, they are the basics. Right from there, we are told that as to the performance of religious ceremonies, as to the performance of the ceremonies of the dead, all these things, there is a guidance provided by him. Because in his time, it was found that although these traditions were there, the attitude behind them was missing. So when he calls Li, L-I, Li, means ritual, what he means is, what is the kind of attitude, the inner attitude you should have when you perform this ritual? Like, if you are mourning, don't wear just black clothes and show that you are mourning, but feel that from within. And it is said that when he found a procession of the mourners passing by, he was moved. He was feeling very bad about it. And at that time, as it was pointed out, that it was said that you have to give them worthy funeral, which included expense. So he just immediately removed one of the horses from his carriage and gave away that man the horse so as to meet with the expenses of the funeral. And when the disciple did not like this, he said that, I don't like my tears not being followed by practical sympathy. Now, he was trying to show what are the rituals for, how you should observe them. If at all you continue in the observance of your ceremonies and all, what is the attitude behind? I think our time is...